Hey, hey, boys and girls, welcome to the NeoWinCast News Edition for April 12th, 2007. Yeah, we've been wondering where we've been to. We're back after a month's break. My name is Chris Vendemio. You know me as BangBang023 on the forums. And joining me, as always, my buddy from over on the other side of the Atlantic, Rob Wright. We call him Rob. How's it going, Rob?
Yeah, everything is really good. Had an awesome time at NeoWindex. Really sorry to see that not too many members decided to turn up. It was an all-staff event, but it went really well, I think.
Yep, we had the NeoWindex in Amsterdam and Chicago. I could make neither, though Rob, I'm presuming, went to the Amsterdam one. I heard the Chicago one became an adult affair, shall we say, and we'll leave it at that. It was a fun time, though, guys. And you should definitely check out for the 2008 plans. They're already discussing it in the site and forum issues forum. Get your voice in there. You know, let them know where you want to go, what you want to do. Maybe we can get some more members down there next time. Hey, maybe even I can make the trip. But a lot has happened in the break, Rob. Well, I don't know if you remember, a few months ago, we actually discussed the possibility of record company EMI Music dropping DRM from their music. And, well, guess what? They did. I liked the idea back then. I wasn't too optimistic that it was going to happen, but it happened. EMI, in partnership with iTunes, has announced that they're going to be dropping DRM from a large portion of their library. They're still going to offer DRM-protected tracks, but they're going to have premium tracks, as they call them, which are free of DRM, and are also at a higher bitrate of 256 kilobits per second. So, you know, you're getting up there. The premium tracks, though, without the DRM, do cost a little more. Instead of paying 99 cents a track for the what you pay right now for the DRM ones, excuse me, you're going to be paying $1.29 for the 256 kilobit DRM-free versions. Not bad. I guess it's the price to pay for freedom. Everything has a cost in this world. And Microsoft actually followed that up with confirmation, I guess we'll call it, that they're trying to move to DRM-free music also. They're not ready to announce something groundbreaking, but they said they're not just working with EMI, they're working with all the record companies. And they're trying to offer DRM-free. They say, we plan on offering it to them as soon as our label partners are comfortable with it. If I know the RIAA, and well, you don't need to know much to know them, I'm going to guess that's never. But hey, you got to be a little optimistic, right? You know, Rob, though, when you look at this, first of all, a question that comes to my mind, the question I think a lot of people on NeoWin were talking about, is the extra 30 cents U.S., I don't know the conversion rates for the England and such, but is the extra 30 cents worth the higher quality and the freedom from DRM?
I think what a lot of people have been saying is that It's fine to offer the difference in audio quality for a higher price, because that's something that obviously it costs them more to store it on the server, it costs them more on bandwidth, and that makes a business sense there. You're paying for higher quality. But I think people object to the fact that they're paying extra for something that they really don't see that they should have had in the first place, which is the digital rights management. Because as we've stated a lot on the podcast before, when you buy a CD, you don't have digital rights management. You can do whatever you like with that CD. You can rip it, you can shove it on a tape, you can listen to it in the car, you can do what you want. And this has not been the case with the digital downloads. So really people are saying, well, yep, thanks for the upgrading quality. I mean, it's basically doubling the quality. We've gone from 128 kilobits per second AAC to 256 kilobits per second, which is a great improvement. And it's something that if you've got decent listening equipment, you are going to be able to tell the difference. But to state that you're having a higher price for removing something that really shouldn't have been there in the first place, I think that's probably a little bit rich.
Yeah, it's... First of all, I just want to point out that Rob just said that if you want to copy CDs to tapes, I don't know if you're living in the early 90s still, Rob, but we've moved past tapes for the most part.
It's okay, as a student, the cars that we own do not necessarily have CD players. So, tapes, I don't know, I think they've still got their place. I really do.
Oh, man, I haven't heard tapes in a long time. But yeah, it's definitely a little odd to me. I mean, the increase in quality, that's beautiful. People, I've been pushing for that for years. I've always felt that 128 kilobits, I don't care what format it is, WMA, MP3, AAC, it's just not high quality enough, especially when you're paying a little more than you would for the CD, generally speaking. So the bump up to 256 is great, except, you know, I don't really feel that I should pay to be able to do with the files what I want when I should be able to do that with the original files that cost less. You know, why should I pay for freedom? Like I said, I know everything has a cost, but 30 cents, that's going to add up very quickly. Three songs and you already shortchanged a song. You could have gotten an extra song if you went with the DRM version. Now, do you think, though, that maybe this higher price is going to be something like the levy they have in Canada, where it's okay to share CDs, but the residents in Canada pay a small tax on all the recordable media up there. So they compensate for that, I guess you can call it piracy, by paying a tax on all their media. Do you think that maybe in this case, the end user has to pay a small tax, so they're not calling it that, you know, to compensate for some of the piracy that's going to result from this?
Personally, I would say, I mean, they haven't marketed it as such. It certainly isn't designed as a tax in any kind of legal setting. That's not what it is. I think really what's happening is it's purely a business thing. Obviously, the track that you're buying, whether or not you should have had it before, they are at a premium quality, and they are at a premium with what you can do with them. So there are significant differences between the two formats that you're buying. And I think they're literally just adding a price because that's the way the business world works. If you have a product that is better, then you charge more for it, and that's just the way it works. Now, what we also have, which is quite interesting, is that you can upgrade any EMI tracks that you've already bought off the iTunes store for a price of 30 cents, which is 15 pence here in the UK. I don't know the euro figures offhand. Now, I've been particularly pleased with seeing this because, obviously, I don't think it's fair that people should have to repurchase and re-download tracks just because they want the new features. So I think this is actually a very good, it's a great incentive for people to actually jump on this bandwagon of finally being able to listen to the music they paid for on whatever player they want. Remember that if you're buying off the iTunes store from May EMI tracks and you decide to buy the non-DRM ones, then you can do what the hell you want with these tracks. You can put them on, you can burn them onto a CD, and you can listen to any music player. You can use Windows Media Player to put it onto any Play for Sure device. So it's not like you're limited to Apple players anymore, which is a wonderful thing. I think it's something we should have had way before now. So when it comes to the premium price, I think it's literally just paying for something which you do get a lot more from it. It's unfortunate, but at the same time, I think it's a wonderful step forward within the industry.
No, it is a nice step forward. I'll agree with you there. But what gets to me here, I'm reading the Microsoft article, and it says over here that EMI has specified that services are free to use whatever format they'd like, including industry standard MP3, which would be the most interoperable option. So EMI is saying, now that we're stripping the DRM out, if you want to use AAC, if you want to use WMA, OGG, MP3, you can use any of those. But do you think that if Apple were to stick to ACC, which they obviously are, and Microsoft to WMA, that there are still going to be issues here and there, and that really the best move for the consumer at this point would be going to the most widely supported format of them all and offering the MP3 versions of the downloads DRM-free? Because I look at it this way. It's great that it's DRM-free now, but my MP3 player doesn't play ACC. It plays at WMA, okay, that's fine, but at the same time, too, I've never really cared for the WMA format. I like the openness of MP3. I like the fact that I know whatever media player on the PC or outside of the PC I use, it's going to play MP3. Do you think that really for any of this to take off to the fullest and to really benefit the consumer, that MP3 has to be used at least somewhat, at least given the option for people to download using that format?
It should be. It really should. Now, EMI have stated that they really don't care the way that their music is sold. They basically what they'll do, they'll deliver their entire catalog in a completely lossless format, and it's up to the store that sells it to repackage it and subject to certain conditions that they have, that they're free to do what they want with it in terms of selling it, as long as the royalties go back to EMI, who in turn will give them to the artists and other such in the management. So from their point of view, they've done the right thing. They've said, yep, we're happy for our catalogue to go in whatever format is best for the consumer. So I'd say, EMI, they've done a good thing here. It's for the Microsofts and the Apples of this world to decide the way they're going to put it. Now, obviously, with the iTunes Store, which is the biggest digital download store that we currently have, they've invested a huge amount in the infrastructure there of encoding everything in AAC and putting it in its little proprietary sort of iTunes format and packaging it. And that works okay. I think, yes, in certain ways, we should be looking in using a more open format. But at the same time, AAC isn't hugely closed. It may not have as many supporters in terms of the players that actually will use it, but also it is an extremely open format, which is a good thing. Apple simply put it in a wrapper, but the actual internals, as far as I'm aware, they're not. It's simply another MPEG standard. But not having DRM protection just means that we can now use some of these programs that will transcode the files into a different file format. However, as you know, Chris, it's you're still going to lose some quality from that.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah, I mean, if I were to download an ACC file and then had to convert it to MP3, I'd be yelling at someone with language I cannot use on this show because of the quality I would lose, just because I feel like being ripped off. But I'm going to make this statement right now to anyone who ever works for these companies who's listening in right now. I know there's like three people who listen to this show, but if you're listening, I will give you my business if you use MP3. Simple, high-quality MP3, none of this 128 nonsense. I want 256, maybe even 192 variable bitrate. It's something good. But yeah, until then, I'll be watching it. I'm sure a lot of people will be watching it. I'm just not sure how far it's going to go. Do you think that maybe the price difference, the 30 cents price difference, is going to, I guess, turn people off from the idea, especially if they're outside the tech community, where they're really not sure what DRM is? You know, they just go on, buy music from iTunes, it works on their iPod, they don't know what's going on. They really don't care about the DRM, they don't know much about it. Do you think that they're really not going to care enough about the high-quality DRM-free tracks to the point where Apple's going to see that maybe it's not a worthwhile investment, maybe it's just not a business that's going anywhere, and they're going to just revert back to what they have been doing all these years?
It would be a PR disaster if they decided to revert. It's obviously the way that the music industry is headed. I mean, customers have made it very clear that unprotected music is something that they really want. And this has been very clear from the discussions we've been having and within the tech community, but also those that do have those frustrations about moving music from player to player. I think what you said about those, for example, just a student or somebody who's just been bought an iPod for Christmas or whatever, using it on their computer, they know that they can buy music off the iTunes store and it just works. You're absolutely right. They're not going to care about... certainly they're not going to care about the digital rights management protection because it's never been an issue for them. It works fine on their iPod. The quality, well, it depends on whether they listen to their music with that degree of concentration, and depends what they're doing with it, of course. But I think really these premium tracks aren't targeted at them. They are targeted at those that do have a particular interest within the industry and who may, do have a number of players that they wish to work with. I think ideally the music industry should be going towards a place where we don't have DRM at all. Now, obviously, that's not up to Apple to decide. It's very, very strict agreements with the music industry and all the major players there, of course. So yeah, I think ideally we shouldn't have to deal with this at all. But it's one of those things, you can't just jump; you've got to transition. So I think we shouldn't underestimate the importance of this announcement that happened. But at the same time, we've got a very long way to go. I'm sure you'll agree with me there.
Oh yeah, I mean I don't see true DRM-free large offerings. I'm saying entire libraries from other record companies for at least 2-3 more years. I really think everyone's going to be watching EMI's sales very carefully at this point and see, is it worthwhile? Is it worth the risk, worth losing some sales to appease the people and, get more money? It's going to be interesting. I say that a lot on this show, I realize, but this is one of those more interesting topics. We've discussed DRM a lot on this show. I can't even fathom how much we've talked about it. So it's nice to see that it's getting somewhere. It's not all just rumor and conjecture. We're actually getting to a point where things are happening. I'm just, it's nice, it's a great first step, but I really want to see the other record companies jump on board. I'd like to see the RIAA take their heads out of their own ass for a few minutes and say, hey, maybe this is a good idea. We're going to move, though, and for those of you who have been listening to the show for a while now, you may want to hold your breath because we're actually going to talk about Linux. I don't think we've ever given Linux any due time on this show. It's one of those things, none of us, I readily admit, I know very little about Linux. The one time I used it, I wound up reformatting my whole system because partition magic screwed up my partitions and my master boot record. Thank you. Rob, I'm not sure what your experience is in the Linux world, but it's an interesting product that was posted on Neowin. It's an interesting idea, and, well, I want to talk about it. One of the Linux distributions, Mandriva Linux, well, they're actually going to be distributing their software on a 4 gigabyte flash drive, which you can boot off of. So I don't know if anyone out there knows, but Linux, a lot of Linux distributions have what they call live CD versions, where you can burn a very basic version of the operating system to a CD, pop the CD in your computer, reboot, boot off the CD, and you're running Linux without having to install it to your hard drive, partition this and that, and all the like. It works nicely, except that it tends to be a little slow. You know, let's face it, we're running off CD here. It's CDs aren't the fastest forms of media in the world. So the guys over at Mandriva, I hope I'm saying that right, it's not Mandriver, I've never said the word before, they decided we're going to put it on a 4 gigabyte flash drive, and we're going to sell it for $175. That's €89. It's a pretty cool idea. I think if the price were lower, I might actually jump in just to play around. Just, you know, I guess it's one of those things where you're sitting there, you just realize, oh god, Windows has totally locked me out of my system, it's gone to hell, what do I do? Well, you pop in your Linux flash drive and you'll be back in there in no time. You know, Rob, is this really what Linux needs, where this can be a big step forward for Linux as far as really getting out there to more than just the Linux zealots? I'm not offending anyone by using that term. And really getting out there more to the general market, people who maybe, you know, the average PC tech guy, I'm trying to find the right word there, who's going around repairing computers, that maybe this is something he can use now, and maybe it can get more people interested in Linux software as a whole, not just Mandriva Linux.
I'm really at a loss as to who they're targeting with it, because there's nothing that's been stopping people doing this with their own USB drives for years, really. This is not something that's new at all. People have been installing operating systems and partitioning drives and making bootable partitions for a very long time. So for that reason, those that are used to repairing PCs, this is probably something they've already been doing. Now, I've been doing it, but not on a USB stick. I've been doing it on a CD, because as we stated before, the benefits of using these live CDs is really great. You can have a usable system which will have, you know, for example, it will have network capabilities, it will have CD burning capabilities, so it works wonderfully as a recovery environment, if you like. If you've really screwed up Windows or done whatever, you can get a lot out of these distributions, and they're great. Ubuntu is another one that has a lot of use at the moment, because, again, it's got a live CD. Nopix is another one. There's quite a few Linux distributions doing this. But as I said before, I'm not sure who they're targeting, because people like me who have used these Linux distributions a bit have already decided to do that, and if I had a spare 4 gig drive around, then I'd be doing that. It's important to remember that all the Linux stuff they're putting on there is free software released under the appropriate agreements there, and so they're including OpenOffice and all the rest of it. So this is software that you could download yourself from the internet, completely legally. So in one sense, they're doing a good thing by demonstrating the possibility, but you're paying a premium for the drive. You're paying for the time that somebody's taken to image these with the appropriate software. So this is something that people who are really serious about it have been doing for a long time. So they're not targeting at them, but amateurs who want to play with it, well, they could just burn it to a disk and they wouldn't care that it's, you know. So I'm not quite sure who they're targeting at. I think, yeah, it's a good idea, but it's not a new one, and people have been doing it for a lot less price for quite some time now.
You know, when I actually look at this, I have a general idea of where they got the idea from and where they're trying to, I guess, target their product. I don't know if you know about the U3 software that's available on many flash drives out there right now. U3 software, basically, it runs on the Windows, doesn't have anything to do with Linux or OS X, but it basically saves your wallpaper, saves your favorite applications such as Skype or anything like that. And anytime you plug it into a new computer, it'll change that computer's desktop wallpaper to your chosen wallpaper. It'll run your programs automatically, such as if you want to run Mozilla Thunderbird or Skype and the such. So it's basically a way of very cheaply and pretty crappily transporting your personal desktop with you. So if you're using other computers on the road, at the office, you can have a sense of familiarity there. I suck at saying that word. So this... I can almost see this being used for that person who travels around a lot, maybe doesn't want a laptop, doesn't feel comfortable carrying one, and they want something better than U3. You have a whole personal OS here on a thumb drive, flash drive, whatever you want to call it. You know, the system configuration, the preferences, all the data, they're all saved to the key, so, you know, next time you boot up, you'll have the same wallpaper, all your Windows, whatever you do in Linux that's configured, it'll be configured the same way. So, you know, it seems to work. It seems like a good idea. The price is definitely a little steep. And I'm sure they're going to have to explain to people what the hell Linux is, because I'm sure most people who would be on the market looking for portable desktops like I'm talking about have no clue what the hell Linux is, but I think that would be the market they're going towards. I'm not sure if they're going to succeed or not. I think it's a cool idea, a little, like I keep saying, a little costly. What can you do? It's definitely a first step in a long road of steps. What do you think, though? This is going to expand way beyond the scope of this story, but that's the way my mind's working right now. What does Linux really have to do to get out there, to permeate the market, and get people to look at it seriously? You know, not just computer geeks. I use geeks in the friendly, you know, a lot of stuff about computers way. You know, what do you think has to be done by Linux to finally get their product out there and accepted among the masses to the point where maybe it can have 1% of the home user market?
Well, because we've got Windows, which is, you know, hardware manufacturers typically target. Now, if they're worth anything, then they also target Mac OS X, which is a nice sizable portion of the market too. But it all comes down to driver support. Now, Mandriva, I'm afraid I don't know. They have pretty good support. You know, it's not too bad. Now, obviously, there's certain issues with wireless adapters, and that's something which Linux has generally been quite bad about in the past. And that's not the fault of the programmers there. It's simply a case of, well, they can't guess the way the hardware works, and it does rely on manufacturers making sure that, you know, specs are out there and they write drivers for it. But by the same token, I think that is stopping its adoption, because there are many issues with drivers, and even if you can get something to work, it may not have the same features. Therefore, it's almost like you're paying for hardware, but you can't use it to its full potential and its full capacity. So that's been something which has really been hampering it. If that can change, then Linux is amazing. It's free, it's very powerful, and the open source nature. Now, it's a debate, of course, but at the same time, because of the fact that it has peer review, it does mean that security has potentially an up on operating systems like Windows, where it's all closed source, because obviously if the whole community can review the source code, then supposedly bugs can get, you know, fixed faster. There's different ways of looking at it. It's a very controversial issue, and people see it from different, you know, different ways. That there is a whole, you know, studies on total cost of ownership when you use Linux servers compared with Windows, for example, and that's, as we said, beyond the scope of this particular item. But I think Linux has so many advantages, and also if you're making a PC on a huge budget, and also for developing countries, for example, you know, we've seen the $100 PC is using a form of Linux because it's cheap, it's very cheap, and it's very extendable. There's a lot you can do with it. So if we can make sure that hardware support is completely up to scratch, then I think you are going to see, you know, a rejuvenation in the market, and you're actually going to see people using it. The other problem I've seen is that there's no standard way of installing stuff on Linux. We've got various package managers, and, you know, some of them are great and they work really well, but there is still this, you know, there's many competing ways of doing it, and that's something that as a community they're trying to standardize and do it, and they're making great ways in that, but it is, I think it is a prohibitive factor at the moment, and something which I encountered when using it. Now most of my experience with Linux is on a server basis, and so I haven't really had to worry about front ends and all the rest of it too much, but when we're talking about in a home market, that's something which is quite important, because you can't have, you know, all the rest of it, you know, compiling the kernel. It's not acceptable for consumers. So I think if we can sort that out, we can sort out a few of the issues, then you know, there's a market there. I think it's a wonderful product. I mean, there's some incredible things you can do with it, but there's just those few little bits that need to be sorted out, I think. I mean, what are your thoughts on that one?
What I really think is that you have Dell hasn't, you know, they started selling Linux PCs, and I think what they have to do is, besides just selling them, they have to offer them as low-cost alternatives to Windows PCs. I mean, let's face it, with the Windows PC, you're paying at least maybe $20 after everything's said and done for the cost of Windows. So maybe they can drop the price, get a cheap Linux PC out there, and people are going to be saying, hey, a $200 desktop, that's decently spec'd, you know, why not? Well, maybe I should look into this. Then again, with Linux, you can't just go pre-installing about 5 gigs worth of garbage and making money off of that. So it's definitely a double-edged sword there. But that's what I really think needs to happen, where a major OEM, Dell, HP, whoever's selling computers in bulk right now, needs to say, here's Linux. We're not just offering it, we're pushing it. we're advertising it, we're letting people know, and we're cutting costs to the point where it's enticing to people, and it's a financial benefit. It's economical choice for people who maybe are in low-income households and such. Until then, you know, if you're selling a Windows PC and a Linux PC for the same price, and you're barely advertising the Linux PC, well, all the hassles that you mentioned with Linux as far as different setup packaging goes, horrible driver support from manufacturers. It's not the fault of Linux, it's the fault of the manufacturers. But, you know, why should I settle for that headache when for the same price I can get a Windows machine where I'm going to have a lot fewer headaches, hopefully? So that's what I really think needs to happen. There needs to be a support from a major OEM to the point where they're pushing it at least reasonably close to the amount that they push their Windows machines. Until then, and I don't see that being for a long time, I just don't see Linux really being able to reach that home user, the guy or girl who really doesn't know what the hell Linux is. This drive, though, on the other hand, I think is a good way of pushing it, because maybe someone buys the wrong drive one time, or maybe they get it as a gift, or maybe they're just curious to see what the hell is going on. You know, it's a great introduction to Linux. No risk of destroying a PC or your current installation of Windows. So it's a nice start. I think it's a step in the right direction, especially as far as commercializing the idea of Linux. But I definitely do need to centralize everything a little more as far as setup packaging goes. Maybe even branding, as far as that goes. You have a million and one distributions, and while that's going to only serve to confuse people. We get confused over six versions of Windows Vista. You know, how many distributions are there of Linux? So it's definitely something that they need to work on. I think this is a great step forward for them, and I'd be interested in seeing how well this thing works. I'm hoping someone out there will eventually review it so we can get a look inside, see what's going on, how well it operates, how well it should function inside the desktop environment. But it should be a pretty cool introduction to Linux for those of us who have never had the opportunity to get a fully functional installation up and running on our systems. With that, though, we're going to get to a topic that I have been following for years. It actually directly affects me because I'm a customer of this company. It's just Cablevision. Recently, a federal judge has deemed Cablevision's idea of a networked DVR illegal. Let me break down some of these terms for you. First of all, for those of you who don't know what a DVR is, it's like a TiVo. If you don't know what a TiVo is, basically it's a device with a hard drive that you watch TV through, and instead of recording shows to a VCR or a DVD recorder on the side, you can record shows right onto the DVR. Moreover, if you're watching a live program, you can rewind the show if you want to replay a scene, maybe a replay a great play in the latest Yankees game. Go Yanks! You know, it basically gives you a lot more power to watch what you want when you want. And right now, DVRs function through actual hardware in the end user's house. My friend, he has a DVR, so he had to go change out his old cable box for a DVR cable box, and he's paying $10 a month now for the DVR service. What Cablevision wanted to do was, instead of giving everyone new boxes, having to pay for the hardware, having to make you go down there, they had the idea, well, why not have it where people can log into an interface on their regular cable box, choose what shows they want to record, we'll record it on our end for them, and they can just download the set, like download the show, like on-demand services work now, and watch it whenever they want. Basically, a DVR that's not in your house, you're just connecting to it remotely. However, the Motion Picture Association of America had some issues with this because they felt that Cablevision was rebroadcasting their content without the proper licenses. So it comes down to, what's broadcasting? In this case, Cablevision feels, well, you know, we're not rebroadcasting it. We'd only let the people watch the show if they chose to record it. If they didn't choose to record it, well, you're out of luck. You can't get it from us, and you can't go on demand and watch it. You know, you have to choose to record it. You have to pay for the service. On the other hand, the Motion Picture Association feels, well, they're making money out of sending shows to the customer without our approval. It's definitely back and forth. As a Cablevision customer myself, I wanted to see this. They announced this way back, I think, maybe in 2004. I thought, wow, this is mind-blowing. This is a great idea. So, you know, Rob, what do you think in this case? Do you think that maybe the Motion Picture Association, in trying to protect its obvious copyright ownership and such, is maybe going a bit too far to the point where not only is it obviously hurting consumers, that it may be shooting itself in the foot a little bit?
I can see what they're doing. Cablevision have come up with a great product. You know, I read about this today, actually. I actually hadn't heard about it. And I do really like it. It's something which is good for consumers, and it gets around some of the issues with, in terms of, you know, space on hard drives and stuff. In a sense, you're kind of streaming the content from their servers down into your house and watching it. Now, you've chosen to record it, if you like. I say record in inverted commas. I found myself, you know, as I'm recording this, putting my fingers up, but you can't see that. It's not a video podcast. However, Neowin, we should do that. That's something for the future. But something like this, it's almost like you're streaming it in. And so, therefore, the concept and the copyright laws related to DVRs, they don't really work in this case, because it is a fundamentally different technology. Now, nobody's doubting that this is great for consumers. It's something which is really good in terms of, you know, making sure that the users doesn't have to worry so much about hardware. If there's bugs, then it's fixed on the server end as opposed to the, you know, the box in the user's home. But there's a lot of, you know, a lot of benefits of doing it this way around. And it's something that I think we should have seen before, but the infrastructure is quite heavy, and it's something that, you know, it's not something you can implement overnight. But I do see, I'm not the greatest fan of these lobby groups like these industry bodies, like, you know, the MPAA and the RIAA. It's, you know, they don't have the best history, should we say, in putting consumers first.
No kidding.
And certainly here, yeah, what they're going about isn't very good on consumers. But I can see it from their point of view. Ultimately, you know, we have a very tried and tested, you know, copyright system related to these DVRs and the way that they work. And this is fundamentally different. And I can see why they feel slightly put out with the method of basically retransmitting the content that is theirs. For that reason, I think it's important that discussion does take place, but I believe that it should have happened as this was being implemented by Cablevision and as it was being designed. It's poor, you know, it's poor to have this going in users' faces and to actually see this going in a court of law. I mean, it's just not the way it should be. This is something that, as an industry, they ought to be talking to each other. You know, they should know what's going on. Obviously, they can't disclose everything they're doing because they have, you know, competitive advantage to think about. But at the same time, when consumers are in the equation, I really think it's important that they talk with bodies like this to make sure that they're not going to suddenly get shut down. It's important that the MPAA does look after their own interests and the interests of the copyright holders, but at the same time, we have to balance that with consumer rights. So, I don't know, I can see things from both sides. I just think it's very poor face that it all happened now and in public, really.
Yeah, I mean, one of the cool things about this, too, was it actually could have benefited the Motion Picture Association, though. Think about it. Right now, with DVRs, what do most people do when they're watching a DVR? Commercial skip, commercial skip, commercial skip. Well, you know, they could have come up with deals with these cable companies to say, well, maybe disable commercial skip on the commercials, you know, so you can't fast forward. It would suck for the consumer, I understand that, but they would have made a lot more money from advertising that way. And also, in the end, it's the same damn thing as having the box in your house. The consumer, there's no difference to the consumer. Isn't that who you're marketing to? Isn't that who you're worried about as far as your copyright protection goes? You want them to see your product. You want to make money off your product. So if I record it on my box right now, well, I don't have a box. Let's say I did. Say I record it now and watch it 3 days from now. Or if I told Cablevision to record it for me and I watch it 3 days from now. And what's the difference in the Motion Picture Association in the end? I understand they have to protect their copyrights. It's law, you have to protect it, because if you don't protect it, you lose it. But at the same point, I mean, give me a break, man. These associations come up with these nitpick ideas that do nothing but screw the consumer over time and time again, and I'm getting into a rant. Todd would be proud of me.
He so would.
I'm just to the point where, especially since this affects me directly now, I was looking forward. I was a young kid. Well, not that. I was about, 19? I was young back then. I was all excited. I'm like, oh, man, this is so cool. Now it's nothing. I mean, it's going to get shot before it even gets out of the, whatever the hell horses come out of when they start the races. Out of the gate. There you go. In the end, though, I mean, Rob, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, obviously, they both have to protect their interests. I really do hope they sit down and discuss this, because this is a benefit to everyone involved. If anyone's going to be paying more, it's going to be Cablevision, because they have to set up the whole system. They already have a great network, though, in the New York area, at least. I mean, I'm getting, 15 megabits down, 2 megabits up for something like $45 a month. I mean, come on, it's beautiful. I love it. And the cable service is great. They offer free high definition, which no one else does, so thank you for that, Cablevision. So, I mean, I don't know. I'd like to see them get together and say, let's not jump to the court so quickly. Let's talk about this. Let's work out a deal. Maybe we can figure something out. But the Motion Picture Association is like the RIAA, and well, their heads are where the sun don't shine. Other than that, Rob, I think we are done. we do have to, before we go, we've missed 4 weeks, so I can't go another week, man, without your quote of the week. Please tell me
it's
you have something
done, hasn't it?
Enlighten me. Yeah, it has
but
to be done.
Course,
if it's not done, the show can't be ended. It's just the way it goes. What's your quote of the week, man?
All right. Let's go for it. Now, we say code of the week. This is more kind of, can we say web design tip of the week? It's not quite as pithy, but let's see if we can get it working. Basically, with this whole, I hate to say it, because I do think the term web 2.0 is skirted around. I just hate it. I think it's, I understand the thing about it, but it's used very inappropriately, and it's sort of ubiquitous on the web now. But when we're talking about designs that are incorporating web 2 functionality, there's definitely a kind of, what should we say? A design that has become very prevalent, and you can see the sites, with the very strong colours and bubbles and shadows and reflections and all the rest of it, which is great. It's just a trend in web design, and obviously you shouldn't use it too much because then you're just sticking with what everyone's doing. But anyway, my tip, if you like, is basically just four words: easy on the reflections. I've seen far too many sites that are using titles, for example, where we've got these, massive reflections, and we've got these huge things which just don't work in terms of the laws of physics at all. It doesn't work in terms of the way light hits anything. We've got shadows coming off at bizarre angles. We've got, lights coming from odd places. We've got shadows, for example, when we've got, a word with a letter that goes beyond the line, like a G. We've got shadows that somehow sort of try and work with that, but it just wouldn't work in physics. Be very, very careful when it comes to reflections on your graphics, because I honestly think it's a lot better to stick with plain text and to do it correctly than it is to just fudge around with physics and just because you think it looks good. It doesn't. And the most effective shadows and the most effective reflections come when you actually take the time to look at the way the real world works. And when you can achieve that, then you get a really neat effect that works well on the screen. But don't jump the gun. Don't jump on the bandwagon, and just be careful. Take it slow and look at things and make sure they look subtle and realistic. Don't go back into the early 90s when we had huge bevels and massive things like that. We're not trying to scare the user here. We're trying to present information and make sure that is at the forefront of what you're doing with your website. Thank you very much. That is my rant over for the week.
Thank you, Rob. And just to follow up on Rob's advice, if you're going to use these big ugly shadows, you might as well put a splash screen, flashing backgrounds, music, and we'll call it a day. Okay, I actually have a two-parter this week, though. First of all, I'm going to give you my song of the week, as always. It's going to be Chevelle, Until You're Reformed. It's from the Daredevil soundtrack. Daredevil was an abysmal movie starring Ben Affleck, but it's actually a very good song from the band. That's Chevelle, Until You're Reformed. Check it out. And I just want to give a quick review of this brand spanking new monitor I treated myself to. I got a Samsung 906BW. It's a 19-inch widescreen monitor, 2 millisecond response time, 2001 dynamic contrast ratio. I believe it's 700:1 actual contrast. 1440 by 900 resolution. It's a beautiful unit, very sleek design. I love the piano black finish. It's very bright. The first thing you want to do out of the box is turn down the damn brightness, otherwise you're going to go blind in a week. Seriously, it's way too high up there. It's a beautiful monitor. I love the picture quality on it. My only beef with them would be two things. First of all, well, three things I'll call it. The stand, on my old Dell monitor, I had a stand that was adjustable as far as tilt, swivel, and height. No one's including height adjustments anymore. I wish they would. It makes a big difference, especially for a taller guy like myself. It saves my neck a little trouble. Two, the adjustment buttons on this, as far as changing the source, getting to the menu and all, are put in such a ridiculously awkward position that I thought I was getting carpal tunnel yesterday where trying to adjust the image. You can move the buttons up a little, guys. It's okay. And thirdly, while they don't give you too much power over adjusting the image as far as gamma and the such go, you have to use a lot of presets. I'm still fighting with the thing over some settings. But this is going to be my call to NVIDIA. Get some damn drivers out there that let me adjust the image as well as I did in XP. I'm waiting on you, still. You and Creative, still. I'm sorry, I bring that up every time we have a show. But I think that's it. I'm done speaking. Rob, I think we're out of points to make. We're out of points to make about 40 shows ago, I think. No, I'm only kidding. But ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. Also, Rob, I want to thank you because Rob's going to be taking over the editing duties for at least a while because, honestly, I'm exhausted. I've been working a lot more lately, and I hate editing, so he can now hate it just as much as I did, but he'll be doing it, actually.
Thanks, Chris. Really appreciate it.
Look, it's for the NeoWin community, man. To get the show out on a regular basis, you got to bear the stress on your back. But seriously, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning back in after we missed a month of podcast. We're going to try to come back on a more consistent basis. I say that a lot, but we really mean it. We just have to realize we have personal lives too. But until next time, ladies and gentlemen of the NeoWin community and everyone out there on the internet, have a good one.